Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Wednesday, December 18th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we are going to gather around the virtual water cooler and talk about what we've been watching. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor and chief film critic, Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
All right, Chris, before we get into what we've been watching, tell me what you've been reading recently.
Yeah, I'm trying to get back into reading. I went through a period where I just wasn't in the right headspace, and now the new year is approaching, I was like, I'm going to get back into reading some books. So I actually finished two books recently. One is Sonny Boy, which is the autobiography of Al Pacino. And I should probably put autobiography in quotes because Pacino himself has even talked about how he used a ghostwriter for this. And you can actually tell when you're reading the book. The book is very clearly Al Pacino sat down with his ghostwriter, told a bunch of anecdotes, and the ghostwriter just transcribed them almost word for word without much cleanup into a book. And that makes for an entertaining and kind of schizophrenic experience because the book kind of just like goes all over the place. You can almost like hear Al Pacino's voice as you're reading the book where he's just like rambling. All in all, I really enjoy reading this. It's a really easy read. I kind of breeze through it. It's fun. I do think it's kind of surface level stuff. Like, he doesn't really go as deep as I wish he would go. It's a very anecdotal book where it's him just being like, this is how I joined the cast of The Godfather. And he doesn't really go much deeper than stuff like, a lot of this stuff it felt like public information. Like, it's not really as in depth as I hoped it would be, but it's a fun read. He talks about pretty much his whole career, and why he's very open about how he took certain jobs because, you know, his accountant screwed him out of a lot of money. Like, he didn't pay a lot of attention to what his accountant was doing at one point. And one day he woke up and he found out he had basically no money. So he just started taking like a lot of like work for hire jobs, which is how, of course, you know, I think everyone knows he ended up in Jack and Jill, the Adam Sandler movie. And, you know, he's very open about talking like about stuff like that. And he talks about how, like, even though he knows he made some not great movies, he always tries to bring something to those movies. So it's a fun read. There's a part where he talks about, like, during COVID, he got really sick, and there was a part where he was like dead for a few minutes, and he was like, when I died, I saw nothing. So I think that confirms there's nothing after death. It's like, wow, Al Pacino, bleak stuff. But it's, you know, despite stuff like that, it's a very light book. It's funny. Like I said, you can sort of like hear his voice in your head as you're reading it. And I really enjoyed it. If you're hoping for a really in-depth exploration of him and his craft, I don't think you're going to get that. But if you want to hear Al Pacino tell some fun stories about, you know, growing up in New York and becoming an actor, you'll get what you want out of that. It's a fun book.
Okay, so that's called Sonny Boy. What else have you been reading?
Yeah, and so I got an advanced reader copy of a new book by Alan Sepinwall, who is, of course, a very famous TV writer. He currently writes for Rolling Stone. It's called Saul Goodman versus Jimmy McGill. And this book comes out February 4th, 2025, but I was lucky enough to get an advanced copy of it. And as the title conveys, it's all about Better Call Saul. And it's a complete guide to the show. And Alan Sepinwall has done this before. He wrote a Breaking Bad book. I think it's called Breaking Bad 101. And this is sort of like the same sort of format where he goes through every single episode. And they're not really recaps because he doesn't like break down every single scene of the episode. It's more of like a glimpse of each episode. And I don't know, what is your take on Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad, Ben? Are you a fan of those shows? Have you watched those shows?
So I have seen all of Breaking Bad, loved it, one of my favorite shows of all time. I actually like El Camino more than a lot of people, the movie that came out that seems to be basically completely forgotten. And then my wife and I tried watching Better Call Saul. We watched the first season and the stuff with the brother, I forget his name, but the like sort of, yeah, Chuck, the electromagnetism stuff and like him wrapping his head in aluminum foil and like whatever the hell was going on there, I think put us off so much that we just never caught up with it. And we've heard such great things about the show that I think that's going to be one that we ultimately go back to and actually finish, because I've just heard from literally every single person who's watched it that it's like a terrific top tier show. So
yeah, I would,
we
really
just didn't really connect with that first season. So as somebody, I know you love the show and you like it more than Breaking Bad. Do you think it gets better after season one? Do you know what I'm talking about when season one's like a little wonky?
I definitely do. And Alex Sebald even talks about this in the book. He talks about how, Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould, I think his name is Peter Gould, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So they were the two showrunners. Eventually, Vince Gilligan left and sort of Peter Gould took over the show. And those two guys, even when they were working on Breaking Bad, they were very famous and very honest about admitting they don't really plan things ahead. They sort of write these shows minute by minute. And sometimes they paint themselves into corners. Very somewhat famously, in Breaking Bad, in the final season, there's a moment where Walter White buys this giant gun and he puts it in the trunk of his car. And they admitted they had no idea what they were going to do with that. And they eventually came up with this idea where he builds this like robot gun that shoots all the Nazis and stuff like that. But like they sort of they just wrote a scene where he bought a gun and they were like, what's he going to do with this gun? I don't know. We'll figure it out eventually. And they had this same approach with Better Call Saul. And when they sat down to create Better Call Saul, their initial thought was the character Saul Goodman. For those who don't know, Saul Goodman isn't his real name. His real name is Jimmy McGill. And the whole plan was by the end of the first season, he would turn into Saul Goodman. And the rest of the show would be this comedy about Saul Goodman. And as they were writing it, they discovered they really liked the Jimmy McGill character so much, they didn't want to turn him into Saul Goodman. So he doesn't really turn into Saul Goodman until like the fourth season, which is like not what anyone was expecting. Everyone was expecting like, this is going to be the Saul Goodman show. And so Alan Sebald talks about how they sort of like discovered the show as they went along. And I feel like if you gave it a second chance, you would probably come to like it a lot. Like, yeah, as you said, like I love Breaking Bad. I think Breaking Bad is fantastic, one of the best shows ever made. But I honestly think Better Call Saul is better when you watch it from beginning to end. I think it's a better show. So having said all that, I love this book. It was a great deep dive into the series. It's got like interviews with the cast and the showrunners and talking about how they came up with certain things. And, so if you're a fan of this show, I really recommend this book. It's made me want to go back and rewatch the show from beginning to end, which I've never actually done that. I have rewatched Breaking Bad like more than once, but I've never actually rewatched Better Call Saul. So I think the time is coming for me to finally do that.
Awesome. Okay. So the title of this book is Saul Goodman versus Jimmy McGill. It comes out in February of 2025. Alan Sepinwall is the author. So definitely put that on your radar if you're a fan of that show. Okay. Let's get into what we've been watching, Chris. I watched a movie for the first time. I watched this film called The Train from 1964. John Frankenheimer directed this, and Kino Lorber recently put out a Blu-ray of it, which looks excellent. Have you ever seen this movie?
Is this the one with John Voight in it?
It has Burt Lancaster.
All right. No, I'm thinking of another. I think a movie I'm thinking of was called like Runaway Train. So no, I have not seen this.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of that. I've never seen it. So the reason that I discovered this movie is because it was on a Slash Film list of like the best action movies of all time. And I was like, what the hell is this? And so I sought out this Blu-ray, and it stars Burt Lancaster playing a French railroad man who, right as Nazi-occupied Paris is about to be liberated by the Allied army, he's tasked with transporting a train full of priceless works of art out of Paris to Germany. And the Nazis are like overseeing this. And it's basically like the same kind of premise as George Clooney's Monuments Men, where it's sort of like, I, you know, let me help you steal our stolen art type of thing. And Burt Lancaster's character is secretly part of this resistance group. So he does everything that he can to sabotage this mission, all while this Nazi colonel gets increasingly and sort of comically frustrated at each new obstacle that he encounters along the way. So this is a really cool movie and it has a lot of practical explosions in it. I watched one of the bonus features and it said that there were something like 150 gigantic explosions, which was the most that had ever been captured on film at that time. And it's very impressive to watch. And like, it doesn't even look like there were any models used in the explosions. Like they blew up full-size trains and stuff for the making of this movie, which is pretty insane. And then there are some stunts that really like made me wince because I could feel the pain these actors felt when performing them. These guys are just rolling down mountainsides and it's like, Jesus Christ, they're really going for it here. So I also found there to be like some pretty interesting shots at the very end of the movie juxtaposing, and this is not a big spoiler, but it juxtaposes human beings with these crates of priceless pieces of art. And it sort of suggests, without explicitly saying so, it suggests through the power of editing that humanity itself is worth saving and is capable of the type of beauty that we typically associate with these painted masterpieces. So in addition to all the cool stunts and all that stuff, there's this human message in there that I appreciated as well. So the movie is called The Train. I'm not sure if it's streaming anywhere right now, but that Blu-ray is really good. So check that out if you're interested. Chris, I think you would like this movie a lot. So
I do love movies about trains. There's just something very cinematic about trains because they're always moving.
Yeah, absolutely. I also watched a movie that I know you've seen, which is Pulp Fiction. I got the 4K of this, which I must say the movie looks fantastic, but the collector's edition component of this 4K that I got is not really going to enhance your viewing experience or your overall experience very much. There are like some lobby cards and stickers and a little thing that looks like a kid's pop-up book in there where Vincent and Mia are dancing at Jackrabbit Slim's as you like open this thing up, but it kind of feels pretty flimsy and it doesn't really add much, but the movie itself is amazing. So I mean, when was the last time you watched Pulp Fiction, Chris? Is this a movie you return to regularly?
I rewatched it, I think maybe last year or somewhat recently, either a year ago or 2 years ago. And yeah, not to be like, have you heard of this movie? But that movie really holds up, man. Like, there's just stuff that like plays so well. Like that Christopher Walken scene is the way Christopher Walken delivers that monologue about the watch, even though it goes to a very silly place where he literally talks about having a watch up his ass. It's so like, it gives me chills the way he delivers that. There's a part where he's like, this watch, and he like whispers it. And I'm just like, oh man, yeah, so good.
Go ahead, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
It's your thing. Yeah, great movie. Just it's so good. Like you can completely under, like Reservoir Dogs is a good movie, but when you watch Pulp Fiction you really understand like why Quentin Tarantino became such a big deal, because it just feels like lightning in a bottle stuff.
Yeah, 100%. And I'm so glad that you mentioned the Christopher Walken monologue, because I had written that down as something that I wanted to talk about here, because I saw this movie a bunch when I was sort of growing up and becoming like a big film fan or whatever, but it's been a long time since I've watched it. It's like at least 15 years. And the only thing I really remembered about the Walken monologue was that part at the end about him talking about having the watch up his ass. But I forgot that it's so much more than that. It's a really long monologue and it's so serious. And it's kind of funny because he's talking to this like, whatever, 8-year-old boy who's just turned off the TV and is like, cannot comprehend the gravity of the story that he's being told. But it's a very serious speech, and like just the way that he delivers that is incredibly powerful stuff. I mean, I kind of, you think about it as a joke, but it's more than that. So
it does such a good job of setting up what comes after, because it completely makes you understand why Bruce Willis's character goes through all this trouble to get that watch back. Like he could easily just be like, you know, I'm free, I can cut and run. But like he needs that watch back. And without that scene, you don't quite grasp why he wants that watch so much. So it's just like, it's such good writing. It's just like Quentin Tarantino, even if you want to be like, I don't like him as a director, you got to admit he is such a good writer. He is such a good writer. He has a way with dialogue. It's like that very few people do.
Yeah, absolutely. And almost every scene in this movie is iconic at this point. I think there's still some stuff in here that kind of raises my hackles a bit. There's a lot of the N-word flying around, which I know Tarantino has been like dinged for using for most of his career. This is not like a new thing. And even at the time, people were complaining about that. But like the movie is just undeniable. You know, it's hard to describe how much it felt like a cinematic bomb had just been thrown into the middle of Hollywood when this came out, and like how influential it was and the ripple effects, and maybe more importantly than anything else, like just how different it was than most of the stuff that that was coming out at that time. So yeah, it's incredible stuff. And you mentioned how you could hear Pacino's voice in that book you were talking about. And I feel the same way about Tarantino in this. Like I can almost hear his voice at the same time as the characters are delivering these lines of dialogue. So, it's like a masterclass in, you know, people always say like trying to, they talk about like finding your voice as a writer. And when you compare Pulp Fiction to everything else that's going on in the mid 90s, this is like a perfect example of a writer who has a very distinct voice. So,
it's one of those movies that you can tell how influential it is because there was like a million movies that came after it that were trying so hard to do what that movie was doing, and none of them come close. There's like so many of like, oh, we need like these quirky hitman movies, and they all stink. It's like you don't like no one understood like how to replicate what he was doing.
Yeah. And Sam Jackson is just in top form in this movie. And I heard a story, I don't know, a year or so ago, that Lawrence Fishburne was actually the person that Tarantino had originally sort of conceptualized that part for, or was trying to offer that role to. And Fishburne's agents made him pass on the movie because of like where he was in his career. It was sort of like a strategic decision to, he wanted to be like more, headlining movies instead of being part of ensembles at that time. And it's just a really fascinating sort of what if scenario to think about what Lawrence Fishburne could have done in that role, because he's great. And it's just Sam Jackson, like this is one of the defining parts of his entire career, and he is incredible in the movie, and like that performance holds up to this day. So
absolutely.
Yeah, just really fun stuff there. Okay. And then I rewatched Interstellar for the first time since Theaters. I watched the 4K disc of this, which actually does have some pretty cool bonus stuff. It has this really, like the edition that I got has these heavy duty patches that you could like sew onto a jacket, and has this booklet of storyboards of the water planet scene. And all right, so I have a little story about Interstellar, but before I launch into that, Chris, what's your relationship with this movie?
You know, it's been interesting. Now, I think it's, what is it? It's like the 10th anniversary this year. Like
it is, yes.
In IMAX. And it's been interesting to see the collective consciousness shift about this, because it seems like almost everyone agrees this is a good movie. And I distinctly remember when this came out, people were not fans of it. And I don't want to be like, I was there first, but I loved this when it came out. I thought it was fantastic. And I remember being surprised at how many people disliked it. Here's my little story. I saw this at TIFF. No, actually, I saw Arrival at TIFF. And when I came out of Arrival, I went to Starbucks. And while I was in line, the barista was like, because I had my badge on, and obviously she was used to dealing with press all that, she was like, what movie did you just see? And I was like, I just saw Arrival. And she was like, oh, I heard that was good. I hear that's the movie Interstellar wanted to be. And I was like, well, I actually loved Interstellar. And she looked at me like I was fucking insane. She was like, really? I was like, yeah. And she was like, okay. And then we just like changed the conversation. So, you know, again, I don't want to brag, but I've always thought this is a great movie. And it's been kind of interesting to see the perception of it change in the 10 years since it came out. Now you tell your story, Ben.
Well, this was the only movie, I think this is true, is the only movie that I did not see a shred of footage of before I went into it. I made the active decision after Inception and really loving a lot of Nolan's movies leading up to that point that I was not going to see. I was like avoiding posters for the movie. I knew sort of like the log line of the film and who was in it, But I was like, I don't want to see a single thing because I watched the teaser for Inception and I was like, all right, that's it. That's good enough for me. And I was blown away by my experience watching that film. And then I was a little disappointed The Dark Knight Rises. And this was his next movie. And I was like, all right, I'm going into this completely blind. So like I did that psychotic thing where like every time the trailer would come up when I was at a screening or something, I would like close my eyes and like hum to myself quietly or something. So like I didn't even know any lines of dialogue. I knew absolutely nothing about the film. And so I went into it with this sort of like wide-eyed wonder of like, all right, Christopher Nolan, blow me away. And I wonder if that impact, I mean, I'm sure it impacted my viewing experience in some way, but I was one of those people who felt a little underwhelmed by this movie the first time watching it. And I, so much so that I have never really been inspired to rewatch it. I just kind of remember thinking like, okay, you know, that was fine, but like not really what I wanted at the time or whatever. And I just rewatched this, or I watched this 4K version, and man, I don't really know what I was thinking. This movie is really good. I know this is lofty praise, but I actually think it gets pretty close to rivaling the effect that Stanley Kubrick was able to conjure in audiences with 2001: A Space Odyssey. Like those IMAX sequences where the ship is traveling through space, like those are just lights out, man. They look incredible. So
that entire like docking sequence is so well done and so intense. I mean, part of that is Hans Zimmer's score, which is phenomenal. But just the way it's shot, like you're to use a cliche, you're literally like on the edge of your seat watching it. You're just like, holy shit, like yeah. And there's this one shot where one character is listening to like nature sounds, and it cuts to the outside, and you see like the ship drifting through space, but you hear like thunder and crickets, and like that just like gives me chills every time I see it, because it's like such a interesting like juxtaposition of like these earth sounds with like the furthest place you could possibly be from earth. I just think this movie is great. I think people were really thrown off by it because Christopher Nolan, he gets accused, like one of the biggest criticisms levied against him besides the, you know, the dead wife thing is his movies are often considered cold and emotionless. And Interstellar leans really hard into emotion. I mean, they literally have a whole scene where they talk about like love being this like elemental force. And I don't think people were like expecting that from a Christopher Nolan movie. And whether or not you think that works is, you know, one thing. I think it works, but I do think that like threw a lot of people off.
Yeah, and he uses the plot of McConaughey's character having to go on this important mission and like losing time and watching his children's lives go by as a really effective metaphor for making a movie, which I don't know if I don't remember clocking that at the time, but I definitely felt it watching this time. Like, you know, he has this relationship with his kids, and like the scene where McConaughey is like breaking down that's been memed to death is such an incredibly effective scene of watching all this time go by that you didn't get to experience because you're doing your job basically. And like, that's such a relatable thing. Obviously people don't relate to being on a spaceship or whatever, but like that feeling, he really gets to the heart of something there that, that I think anybody can relate to. So,
I mean, it's like heartbreaking. And it's also like, there are like horrifying things in the movie. Like there's that part where they go to the planet with the tidal wave and like time is different. And when they finally get back on the ship, I think like they say like 7 years has passed, some insane amount of time. And the first shot is, I forget the character's name, but it's the guy who stayed behind. And he's
Romilly, I think is his name.
Yeah. And he's like noticeably older. And it's like, it's jarring because like the last time we saw him, he looked relatively young. And now he's this older guy. And for us, only a few minutes have passed, but like it hammers home like, holy shit, like all this time has gone by. And that's genuinely, unnerving. It's just like stuff like it just like the movie, like, you know, time is a big thing for all his movies, deal with time on some level, and this movie really sort of like hammers that home, that like time is this thing that like we really can't. I feel like Christopher Nolan is really obsessed with controlling time, and I feel like this movie illustrates that he realizes like the folly in that, like, you know, you can't control time. And this movie does a really good job highlighting that, where it's like, even like when Matthew Connay sort of goes back in time and goes behind the bookshelf, like he's not really going back in time. He's not like changing things the way he wants to. I don't know. It's just like, it really gets to you on this, like, like, holy shit sort of level. Like,
yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I also, like, the last thing I'll say about it is I think this movie is more relevant now than it was in 2014, because I had totally forgotten there's this bit in the beginning about schools rewriting history books to indicate that the moon landing was fake.
Yes.
And McConaughey's character obviously, like, takes issue with that because he used to work for NASA and he knows that this is bullshit. And, like, there's just something about that aspect of it that rings way more true to me now, unfortunately, than it did 10 years ago. So, yeah, I guess, like, shout out to the movie for being prescient in the worst possible way. But yeah, there's that. Okay, so let's take a break and then we'll come back and get into what you've been watching.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, Chris, tell me what you've been watching recently.
Yeah, so I finally saw Wicked, the one of the biggest movies of the year. You know, I don't want to go off too much because I know people love this movie. People are huge into this movie. And I know you even yourself, Ben, said you liked it. I'm sort of like in the middle. My biggest problem with Wicked is, you know, I want to preface this by saying I love musicals. I'm a big musical fan. I don't think the majority of the songs in Wicked are very good. I think it has two great songs, and those are the two songs everyone knows. They're Defying Gravity and Popular. Those are great songs. I feel like every other song is kind of forgettable, and I feel like that's a problem when you're making a musical. Like, I could not tell you, I guess, like, Dancing Through Life is the only other one I could think of. Like, I can't tell you what any of the other songs are called. Like, none of them stuck with me, and I think that's a problem. I also think the movie does not look as good as it should look. It's got this very weird washed out thing that is sort of a problem with modern movies in general. I was talking about this on our Slack today. The teaser of Superman came out today, the James Gunn Superman, and there are multiple shots that are incredibly washed out. And they're overexposed, and I don't understand why they look like that. Like, why do they look like that? Like, there's no reason for your movie to look like that in the state. I guess it's just like a product of shooting things digitally. I don't know. Like, I'm not a photographer. I don't know the ins and outs of photography, so I don't know what makes cinematographers and directors decide that this is how their movie has to look, but. Mm-hmm. I don't like it, and I wish it would stop. And I don't think you need to make your movies like that, because there are examples like The Batman came out 2 years ago. That's a blockbuster. That movie looks amazing. Or more recently, Dune, the Dune movies. Whatever you think of those movies, and ironically, all three of these movies I just mentioned have the same cinematographer. So maybe the secret here is to hire Greg Frazier. But like. You can make a modern blockbuster that looks really good, even if you're shooting on digital. And for some reason, a lot of filmmakers don't know how to do this. Like Deadpool and Wolverine, that movie looks hideous. Like, what? Like you don't have to do this. You can make your movies look good. And but at the same time, I recognize that like no one else seems to share this opinion because everyone loves this movie. So yeah, that's where I am.
Fair enough, Chris. And I actually agree with you about the music component. I think I was very like swept away by it and charmed by the performances. But I, you know, sitting here with you right now, I can't really think of the lyrics or the title of any other songs aside from those two that you mentioned. So
yeah,
I agree that I think the experience would have been better if the music was maybe a little bit more memorable to people who are not like already super fans of the Broadway experience or whatever. So
yeah,
that's Wicked. It's in theaters right now. What else have you been catching up with?
I saw A Complete Unknown, which is the Bob Dylan movie starring Timothy Chalamet. I reviewed this for slashfilm.com. This is directed by James Mangold, who of course also directed Walk the Line. And it's kind of, I don't know if ironic isn't the word, but it's interesting that he's returning to this musician biopic genre, because famously Walk the Line was very famously parodied in the hilarious movie Walk Hard. That movie is a parody of musician biopics in general, but it's very specifically parodying Walk the Line and Ray, the movie about Ray Charles. And I say this in my review, but it's kind of I kind of commend James Mangold for being brave enough to return to the genre after Walk the Line sort of like mocked his movie so mercilessly. I think this movie is okay. It's very safe. It's very predictable, which I feel like is not what you should be doing for a movie about Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan is, whatever you think of Bob Dylan as an artist, part of the reason he became so iconic is he took all these risks and he constantly reinvented himself. Like, there is no one Bob Dylan. And ironically, there's a completely different movie all about this. It's Todd Haynes' I'm Not There. Have you ever seen that?
I have not. No, this is the one that has like multiple people playing Bob Dylan.
Yeah. So like Todd Haynes' I'm Not There, to highlight the fact that Bob Dylan had so many different personas, he literally casts a bunch of different actors to play Bob Dylan through various eras. And like at one point, Kate Blanchett is Bob Dylan. Christian Bale and Heath Ledger are both different versions of him, which is ironic because they were in The Dark Knight together. So that movie is much better than this. All that said, this movie is really well made. It's entertaining. Timothée Chalamet does all his own singing, and he does a pretty good job of sounding like Bob Dylan. And it helps that all the songs are just so good. Like, I don't know what you think of Bob Dylan, Ben, but like I went through a Dylan period when I was like in my early 20s, where I was like listening to a bunch of early Bob Dylan stuff. And I hadn't listened to that stuff in a while, and hearing it again in this movie, it reminded me of like, oh, these songs are really good. Like, I understand why Bob Dylan is Bob Dylan. And and the movie is also, it's very smart in that it's not a cradle to the grave. I mean, it can't be because Bob Dylan's still alive, but it's not like a childhood to end sort of biopic. It's just like a certain slice of Bob Dylan's life. It's like when he arrives in New York and it sort of explodes on the folk scene, and it ends with him pushing back against the folk. Like, Bob Dylan became a very famous folk singer, and at some point he realized he didn't want to do that anymore, and he famously went electric. You know, after being a folk musician, he started playing with a full band and electric guitars, and a lot of his fans felt that was like a betrayal. It was like, you know, you're not a folk singer anymore, you're a rock star, and we hate you for that. And this movie is sort of about him being uncomfortable with his fame and being like, I'm gonna do something different. And it sort of ends with him starting a new phase of his career. It's well made. The cast is really good. Edward Norton is really good in this, playing Pete Seeger, another folk singer. Monica Barbaro, who she was on that show with Arnold Schwarzenegger. What the hell was that called? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah, the Netflix show?
I think it was called Sabotage. I don't know what it was called. It was not good, but she's in this. She plays Joan Baez. She's really good. Like, it made me wish the movie was like a Joan Baez biopic instead, because she's so good at it. So, if you're expecting something great, that's not what this is. But if you want like an entertaining Christmas Day movie, I think you would enjoy seeing this general public.
I have complicated feelings about one aspect of this, Chris, and I think you touched on it. The idea of like the fan reaction to Dylan going electric at the end of this movie. I'm loath to ever put power in the fans or in the hands of fandoms, because I just think that's a bad idea. And kind of focusing on fandoms in movies, I think, is also unnecessary for the most part. But right. I do think there may have been an opportunity here to focus a little more on the public reaction to Dylan and that decision that he makes, and like have that serve as a metaphor or some sort of commentary on the modern state of fandoms. And the movie's not really interested in that. I thought that was like maybe a slight missed opportunity or something, where they could have used that to sort of kickstart a larger conversation about that.
That's really good.
Yeah, my take on this is that it's basically the same theme as in Ford versus Ferrari, which is like the idea of pushing back against the expectations that people have of you and breaking out of the box, and like the whole thing being a metaphor for working inside the studio system while all these forces are kind of like demanding certain aspects of you. I think that stuff comes through really well in the final act of this movie. And I think the whole, I don't know, first two thirds of it is just kind of like typical biopic stuff that, like, if you like the music, you're going to dig the movie, but there's not really much going on there. So yeah. I think I read your review and it sounds like we're pretty aligned on our overall feelings on this movie. So
I do think the movie deserves some credit for not being afraid to kind of paint Bob Dylan as a kind of a dick. Like at the end of the movie, like, it really underscores the fact that even though that, you know, Pete Seeger and the folk community took this guy in and helped him become what he is, he sort of just like turns against all of them for no reason other than the fact that he's just listless. And if if you're in his head, it makes sense. But if you step back a few feet, it's like, this guy is being a huge asshole to everyone who sort of helped him out. And I kind of liked that the movie wasn't afraid to sort of underscore that. Like, it doesn't like sugarcoat the fact that, like, this guy is a great artist, but he also kind of treated all his friends like dicks. And I kind of appreciated the movie didn't shy away from that.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So what else have you been watching, Chris?
I wrote like a little sort of like blurb about it on the site. Carry On, which is now on Netflix. How do you say this guy? I never get his name right. It's
John? Oh, yeah. There's been, so much like back and forth. Because I was talking about this with Brad or Ryan on a recent episode. I think it's, I think it's Jaime? I'm not sure, honestly.
I should know this guy's name pronunciation because I love his movies, but I never know how to say it. But let's say Jaime Colette Sierra. He has a certain niche where he directs really trashy but really stylish movies. He made Orphan, which is one of my favorite horror movies. He made the House of Wax remake, which is a lot of fun. And he did a bunch of movies with Liam Neeson. And he also did The Shallows, that really fun shark movie with Blake Lively. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, he started making really bad blockbusters with The Rock. He made Jungle Cruise and he made Black Adam. Neither of those movies are good. So I was like, boy, I miss I miss that guy. And this movie, Carry On, is sort of like a return to form for him. It's very much that sort of stylish, trashy action pick. It's very much cut from the same cloth as Die Hard. It's not as good as Die Hard, but it's that same sort of movie where it's this action movie about this everyman hero set on Christmas. So if you're a diehard fan and you want another movie in that same sort of vein, this will scratch that itch. Taron Egerton is a TSA agent, and Jason Bateman is a terrorist trying to smuggle this device through security. And I had a lot of fun with this. Jason Bateman is really good at playing a bad guy. I never watched Ozark. I understand he sort of is a bad guy on that, but I never watched that. But he played a bad guy in The Gift, which is this horror movie directed by
Joel Edgerton, I think.
Joel Edgerton, yeah. Right? Joel Edgerton, he directed it and he's also in it. And in that movie, it's slowly, like, you think that Joel Edgerton is the bad guy in that movie, and he is kind of a creep, but it's slowly revealed that Jason Bateman's character is the real villain of the movie. He's just like a piece of shit. And Jason Bateman is actually really good at playing pieces of shit. And he does that really well in this movie where he plays the bad guy who's just sort of like very driven, and he doesn't really care who he kills as long as he gets his way. And the whole thing is set on Christmas. There's like this entire one take chase sequence set to Wham's Last Christmas. That's a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun watching this. I watched this with my girlfriend. She had a lot of fun watching it too. So it's a crowd pleaser. It's a shame that, like, 20 years ago, this movie would probably go to theaters and be a hit. But, you know, the world we live in now, it goes right to streaming. And but it seems like it's a hit on streaming, so I'm glad people are watching it.
Yeah, I think this is definitely, like you said, a crowd pleaser. I watched this as well, and it's like a fun enough movie. I do think everyone is praising it because it reminds them of movies, like you said, that we used to get all the time. I do want to just call out that there's one of the worst car crashes that I've ever seen in my life in this movie, because it is all like digital and just looks terrible, like comically bad. So I did want to, whatever the opposite of a shout out is, I wanted to give that to that particular scene. But not to like take this movie down a peg or whatever, but I did just want to call that out because I think people are like universally praising it. And I'm like, I enjoyed it, but there was this one moment that like, I was like, woof, good God, how did this make it through? But anyway, carry on.
I wish they could have done that like practically, but I understand what you're saying, definitely.
So that's on Netflix. And then you got a couple other things too, right?
Yeah. Speaking of crowd pleasers, I missed this in theaters. I finally got a screener of Conclave. Have you seen this, Ben?
I have. I liked it a lot. What'd you think about it?
I loved Conclave. I don't think it's like best of the year material. What I find interesting about Conclave is it reminded me a lot of two David Fincher movies, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and Gone Girl, which I should add, I think are better movies than this. But it reminded me of those because both of those movies and Conclave, they're very much trashy airport paperback thrillers that are dressed up like prestige movies. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I just think it's kind of funny. But this movie is a hoot, man. It's just a bunch of cardinals acting catty and vaping and looking at each other with like frowns and stabbing each other in the back. And it's got this big twist ending that I don't think anyone would see coming. I knew about it because I actually read the book over the summer to prepare for the movie, so I knew it was coming. But if you hadn't read the book, I don't think anyone would have seen it coming. But I had a lot of fun with this. It's really entertaining. It's really handsomely made. It's got a great score. I thought the soundtrack is just so cool, the way it's very propulsive and moves things forward. And it's got a great mood to it. Like there are all these like random mood setter shots of like people just hanging out in the Vatican. It's like they're not part of the plot, they're just there to like set the mood. And I had a lot of fun with this. Ralph Fiennes, always great. Everyone is actually really good. Stanley Tucci, John Lithgow playing a piece of shit. Just a lot of fun. I don't know the actor's name, but the vaping cardinal is great. Even though he's an awful racist, you kind of just love to hate him because he's very funny taking vape hits. I like, this is the type of movie, like when it was over, it was like, I gotta watch that again because I had so much fun watching it. It's a lot of fun. Conclave.
Absolutely. Yes. I'm checking to see.
This is on Peacock right now, actually.
I was gonna say, yeah, it's streaming on Peacock, so that's perfect. So people can watch it there. And yeah, highly, highly recommend. This is like, it's definitely going to end up on my personal top 10. Not that I don't think we're publishing those at Slash Film, but I'm probably going to make one in the next couple weeks here just for my own edification or whatever. And this will almost certainly be on it. So, all right. What else have you been watching, Chris?
Two more. I saw Speak No Evil. This is the remake of the Danish movie of the same name. I liked the Danish movie, but it was so bleak that I never want to watch it again. And I got to say, I actually think I like the remake more. Without giving away spoilers, the remake does change the very shocking ending a little bit. That might rub people the wrong way. And they might accuse it of like chickening out and not going as bleak as the Hollywood ending. But I just think this is a more enjoyable film, for lack of a better word. Like I said, the first movie is so nasty that it's like, I don't really like watching this. Whereas you kind of have a fun watching this version because James McAvoy playing the villain is so much fun at playing this scumbag. So I enjoyed watching this, I gotta say. So Speak No Evil remake, pretty good.
Yeah, really, really fun stuff. I did not see the original, but I did see this remake and really had fun with it. And McAvoy, I think it's like legitimately one of the best performances he's ever turned in. I think he's just like really having a blast and like able to do a lot of different stuff with this within the same performance. So
He's really good. He's really good at making this guy deceptively likable. Like you can almost understand why everyone gets like suckered by this guy, because it's like, oh, he's charming and he's got really good muscles, but then it's like, oh, he's a monster. But you sort of understand why people like fall for his shtick.
100%. All right. So the last thing that you watched, you rewatched Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah. So I've been watching a lot of Christmas movies. It is the Christmas season. I'm not going to talk about all the ones I rewatched, but I just wanted to bring this up. Every year I make a point to rewatch Eyes Wide Shut, which I just love. I love Eyes Wide Shut so much. I don't want to be like one of those people who's like, it's my favorite Christmas movie, but it really probably is my favorite Christmas movie. It's like this and The Muppets Christmas Carol are like my two favorite Christmas movies. It doesn't feel like Christmas unless I'm watching this movie, which is so weird because this movie came out in June, which like blows my mind to think about. Like when it opened in 1999, it opened in June, and it's like, it's so synonymous with Christmas to me. I can't imagine watching this in the summer. Yeah, just a wonderful movie that I love rewatching every year. Not my favorite Kubrick, but it's definitely up, probably like my top three, one of my top three Kubrick films.
What do you think about the Tom Cruise walking on a treadmill in front of the rear projected background thing? Like, I've seen photos of like the behind the scenes of how that was done. They're always popping up on like film accounts on Instagram and stuff like that. And Kubrick like famously did not want to travel back to the United States to film this movie. So he filmed the whole thing in the UK and was trying to like recreate the streets of New York City in this very elaborate sort of workaround to shooting something practically. So do those moments like stand out to you when you're watching them, or how do you think about those?
No, you know, even though I know when they're happening, I kind of think it works in the context of the film because the whole movie has this sort of like dreamy late night vibe to it. It's literally about this guy wandering around late at night, and the whole thing has this sort of like surreal quality to it, and I kind of think those shots kind of seem appropriate. Like they won't bother me. If anything, I think they sort of like enhance the vibe of the film.
Excellent. So do you own this, Chris, or do you stream it somewhere?
Yeah, I have it on Blu-ray. Hopefully one day we'll get like a 4K, but I don't know if we will, but for now I have the Blu-ray.
All right. Excellent. Well, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about pretty much every movie that we mention on the show at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a couple things in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. We'd really appreciate that. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you all tomorrow.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.